No hope. No hope, because the Japanese were determined to fight to the last man, woman, and child. And the Allies were calling for unconditional surrender. American soldiers in the Pacific had to believe they would not survive the war. The Japanese commanders now knew they could not win the war. Their navy was destroyed. Their army was succumbing to the Allied offensive from island to island. But they hoped to make it so costly for the Americans that their resolve to win would break down, and that at least there would be a stalemate or more favorable conditions for surrender. And then the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima, the other on Nagasaki, at the cost of zero American lives. The Americans had proved they were capable of and willing to kill hundreds of thousands of Japanese. And suddenly the tables were turned. No longer was this going to be a costly war for the Americans, but the resolve of the Japanese commanders broke down, and they surrendered unconditionally, as they had not ever planned to do. Now, looking back, hindsight is always 20/20. But if the commanders of the Japanese Imperial Army had been able to look ahead and see that in a few short weeks they would be surrendering unconditionally anyway, do you not think they would have considered more seriously unconditional surrender prior to the devastation of two productive cities and the deaths of hundreds of thousands? Looking back, of course, certainly it would have been wiser. However, no one can see into the future, not with ultimate clarity anyway. However, Jesus does seem to suggest that we all have some ability to look into the future, to look at our situation, predict our future course, and how we may react and respond, and to make decisions, to make course corrections and adjustments according to what we believe we would do if we face what we believe we will face in our future. And Jesus gives an illustration to that effect here in Luke 14. A war illustration, no less. That reminded me of the outcome of World War II. Luke 14, starting with verse 31. Suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down, attempt to look into the future, consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with how many?
20,000.
Not the best of odds. If he is not able, If looking into the future, he predicts a slaughter. If looking into the future, he says, I can't afford to lose my entire army and be forced into unconditional surrender at the end anyway. If that is the case, what does Jesus suggest this king will do? Anyone? You can summarize in your own words.
Try and make peace before he loses everything.
Yeah. While the enemy, while the opposition is still far off, is the time to send out a delegation seeking terms of peace. You know, if the Japanese had sought terms of peace much earlier in the war, perhaps there's a good chance they could have gotten something other than unconditional surrender as the terms of peace. While the enemy is far off. Well, we can see the wisdom in this. If you're going to end up surrendering unconditionally anyway, you might as well go and ask for the best terms you can get as early as possible. It can't be any worse for you in the end. And if you save thousands of lives, bloodshed, destruction of property, sure sounds like it's at least a commonsensical idea to give in early. Go and make peace. But what is Jesus really getting at here? This is a parable. It's an illustration. Jesus is not really intending to give us a course in military tactics. Is he? No, he's not expecting you and I to be going to war against any other power on this earth anytime soon. So what is he dealing with here? In this whole section, as we look back, what is he talking about that he has now turned to this war illustration to illustrate? Yes, yes. The previous illustration had a lot of similarities, not to start something you can't finish. But there as well, it's an illustration where it's building. He isn't really trying to give them instructions about general contracting. He is giving them instructions about something else, using building as an illustration and now using war as an illustration. What is the something else that he's instructing them about? Ken?
Is he talking about that as a disciple, we will fight with the forces of the devil? And if you look at the issue and decide you don't want to fight, then it's best to go ahead and surrender to the devil and become a minion of his than to fight and then lose and then go through the whole surrender.
And get there anyway. Yeah, it's very similar to the tower story. He's actually teaching a lesson about discipleship, about what it means to follow him, what it's going to be like to follow him. And he is making the comparison here that to follow me is going to be an awful lot like going to war against the odds. Now, I don't mean that you're fighting against the odds, but getting yourself into a war situation where it's 2-1. Were you going to say more, Ken?
Now, this seems to conflict with a lot of things that I've heard, that, you know, become gods because his yoke is easy, his burden is light, I've already got the victory for you, and now now Jesus is saying, oh, wait a second, it's not going to be easy, it's not going to be without cost, it's not going to be without strain and stress.
Yeah.
That.
So which one is true? Yeah. Both are true. Both are true. There is no more peaceful place than following Christ. Internally. But there is no more dangerous place on this planet than following Christ. Externally. The Hebrew worthies standing in front of the fiery furnace seem to have been at peace internally. Surrounded by conflict. Yelling and screaming, threats, fire, soldiers, violence. They had no reason, really, unless God intervened, to expect to get out of that alive. And though they did, many other of Christ's followers have not. And that is the reality that Jesus is bringing up here. If you're going to follow me, you should expect it to be like going to war against someone who outnumbers you 2-1. And if there is any relationship that you hold dear, if there is any possession that you cannot live without, if there is any position that makes you comfortable, if there is any comfort you cannot do without, that would cause you to turn back in the face of threats against it, he's saying you might as well not start. Why should you get 3/4 of the way through the battle, lose your father, mother, brothers, sisters, only to find out at the end that you can't stand losing your health and you're going to throw out your faith in order to, quote unquote, make a deal with the devil. So he says it would be better to sue for peace early. Go ahead, Ken.
Was this a message that he was giving to prospective disciples?
What's the context?
The Pharisees and stuff were there.
Well, it changes, right? He's just gone out from the house of the Pharisees. And who's he addressing here? Yeah, the large crowds. There were people following Jesus all over the place. Crowds of people. Some of them in the crowd were his disciples, right? People who had a more formal commitment to him. But there were all kinds of people who saw themselves as his followers. I mean, they literally were following him around from place to place. And it's this group of people that he's addressing, I think, largely, and this is what we talked about the last couple of times, because just because you happen to be following Jesus from place to place doesn't mean that you're really his follower. You might discover at some point when he goes this way that you were traveling where he was traveling, but really you were going that way, and your paths just happened to converge for a while. And so it seems to be these people that he's addressing. Don't fool yourself that you're following me just because you're in the crowd. Anybody could be in the crowd for a time. So did that answer?
Yeah, I've never heard this message in an evangelistic series.
Maybe we ought to preach it in an evangelistic series more often. That's an interesting point, because, I mean, in an evangelistic series, we're trying to make everybody feel comfortable and come on in. And sometimes, once they're in, we wish we hadn't done that. And I don't mean that in any nasty way, but all I simply mean is sometimes we convince people of a pretty picture that ain't true. And sometimes we get the crowd in the church, their names on the books, but they still just happen to be traveling the same direction for now.
They continue to their destination, it's just not where we're headed.
And it would be better if they had never joined up when that split happens. For any number of reasons. The damage it does to the church, the damage it does to them, the damage it does to those looking on. So Jesus was not stupid to preach this message in his evangelistic series. He knew what he was doing. And he is, it's quite a strong message. Quite an interesting message. So, if you're outmanned, outgunned, cannot finish the fight on the side of righteousness, it would be better never to begin it. If Ken is right, and the opposing power that we are in war with, if we follow Jesus, is the devil, then what would Jesus be saying when he says, go and make peace early if you're not going to follow through? What would that mean? To make peace with the devil.
Give up the fight.
Yeah? To promise I won't get in your way. To say, can I keep all my stuff? Ultimately, this is a very sad picture. Because you need to know something about the devil at war. He does not take prisoners.
He wants you dead.
Now, he doesn't care if you're comfortable in this life. But if you surrender, he puts you in line for execution. And he doesn't mind if you're comfortable in the waiting room for the death chamber. We call it the United States of America. And you understand that's a joke. But part of his plan in this world is to make people so comfortable that they won't resist him. And he doesn't care how comfortable you are as long as you don't get in the way. Because he knows when it's done, he gets what he wants. So Jesus is essentially saying, why fight and struggle against the devil if you're going to submit to death at the end anyway? You might as well make your peace with him early because you're going to die. At least you can be comfortable while you're waiting in the death chamber. Is this what Jesus really wants? No, certainly not, right? He is telling us this to point out the utter folly of doing anything but resisting with everything you've got, even at the expense of your own life, against the devil. Because there's no point keeping this life at the expense of the real life to come. There's no point. As we quoted, what was his name? Elliot. Can't remember his first name last time. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Let me say it again. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep. You can't keep this life. All of us are going to the same place. To gain what he cannot lose. That was a quote from a missionary who people couldn't understand why he went to this dangerous tribe of people who tended to kill outsiders and eventually was killed. But not till he stated his position on the matter. And eventually, if I'm recalling right, his wife continued the mission on, and they gained ground with those people.
That was in the
I don't recall. I thought it was South America, but that's been a little while since I've read the story, and so I'm not sure. Could be. Could be. I'd like to see it. Reminds me of a story that Morris Vinden used to tell about going up in the elevator in the Empire State Building, and on the 66th floor, somebody walks in. He says, "I think I recognize this guy. He's a billionaire." And end up on the top floor and walk out across the roof. And the guy says, "I've got a proposition for you. I want to give you $1 million. "Really?" "Yeah, but there's some conditions. You have to spend it within a year." "Well, I don't like those conditions too well, but that's better than no million at all. What else?" "And at the end of the year, you have to come back and jump off this roof. Go splat on the ground." Not such an attractive proposition anymore. Like I said, the devil doesn't care if you're comfortable. He doesn't even care if you're happy. As long as you agree to his terms, and he wants you dead. Now, we looked at each of these stories so far from two directions, right? We noticed that Jesus is telling us something about our experience of discipleship, but in each one, he gives a mirror image of his experience to gain disciples. That while he tells us, "You can't be my disciple unless you hate father, mother, brother, sisters," he also left his family to come here so that we could be his disciples. Just like he says, "Don't bother building a tower if you're not going to finish it," we noticed he had to decide, is it worth it to enter into this endeavor? And that before he ever laid the foundations of the world, he said, "It is worth the cost to me to have a relationship with my lost people again." He had his eyes open the whole time. And so likewise, I'd like to look at this story from the other side. Right? Was God ever at a time and place when he had to decide whether he was going to wage war or settle with his enemy? Where was that? When did that begin? Well, we know that there was war in heaven. Now, there hasn't always been war in heaven. So there was a point at which God said, "This has gone far enough." And we're told that there was found no place for the devil and his angels. They were cast out. If we go back to Genesis 3:15, we find out that even then, God was committed to finishing this war, even though he knew it would cost him dearly. Now, Genesis 3:15 is a very familiar passage. "I'll put enmity between you and the woman," of course, talking to the serpent, "and between your seed and her seed," and the prediction that he will crush your head and you will bruise his heel. Paul tells us very plainly that the seed, singular, of the woman is Christ. Right? That's Galatians 3:16. And so the prediction here lets us know God knew and understood already, "I'm going to continue this war until I have destroyed Satan. And I know that that will come at pain and cost to me." Now, personally, I'm quite glad that God is not even considering peace with the devil. I was listening to some of Gary Vinden's talk from, I think it was 2006 camp meeting, and he said, "I'm glad God hasn't set up a little corner of the universe where the devil gets to do his thing throughout the rest of eternity." Right? He has committed himself to bringing an end to the devil and his works. He has not set up a corner of the universe where the devil gets to go on and run things his way. That's good news. Amen. Right? God is not settling with the devil. Because if he was going to, he should have done it long before now. Pardon?
Could have kissed off the earth.
Yes. Could have saved himself a lot of pain. He could have saved us Hiroshima and Nagasaki, among many other atrocities. He should have done it long before now, if he was going to. And so, in a roundabout way, the pain and suffering and death and sickness that we experience today, this is a roundabout way, but is a reminder that God is going to finish what he started. Because we wouldn't have had any of this if he wasn't going to finish what he started. But you know, it's not entirely that simple. Is it? Because Satan and his demons are not the only ones who find themselves in opposition to God in this universe. Well, let's go there.
Don't you think that it would just be easier if we would just give in to God than to spend our life fighting? Is that where you would take it?
Now, I'm going to take an intermediate step before we get that far. We'll come back to that for just a moment here. Can God win the war against us? Can God win the war against the devil? Well, what do you mean by win? What does God want, really? How does he feel about the devil? So God can extinguish the devil and all of his works, but has he really won? He hasn't got what he wanted. And likewise, God can extinguish us. He can administer justice. He can stop our bad influence. He can put an end to our suffering and misery. But can he win? Yes. He cannot, through force, achieve what he really wants. He can only administer justice.
God is pure love here. He has strict rules of engagement. That if he wanted to, he could nuke us.
Yes.
But that would not win the war. That would just end the battle. And he wants to win the hearts and lives of us. And so, he can't nuke us. He's got to woo us and pursue us.
He looks at this war and he says, in essence, I'm terribly outnumbered. Not that he's lacking power, but there's nothing that he can do with power that can get him what he wants. So looking down at the future through those eyes, what does he decide to do? Karina said, choose weakness. That's an interesting way of putting it. What does he actually decide to do out of this parable? He sends his son. How? For what purpose?
Redeem himself.
Yes, but stick with the language of the parable. Yes, as a delegate seeking terms of peace. And what did we do with the delegation sent from heaven under a white flag? We responded with violence. So was the delegation successful? Amazingly enough, yes. Because the one thing that power could not do, win hearts. Weakness could. And some, at least, among us on this planet, looked at the blood dripping from their hands and said, I cannot believe what we just did. And their hearts were broken. Surely this man was the Son of God. And their hearts were broken. And they saw clearly for the first time that all this business of enmity with God was based on a lie. Because here God came at great risk and cost to himself, made himself vulnerable, submitted to our abuse. Is this a God who is waiting to punish, trying to kill, who has enmity toward us? Certainly not. So the enmity is all on our side, not on his side. Maybe, just maybe, if we looked at the war realistically, we'd see we can't win by fighting either. I mean, what if we succeeded in rebellion against God? We take him down. We destroy his kingdom, his rulership. We kill him. What have we just done to ourselves? You unplug the blender? Buttons don't work anymore. There is no life apart from God. And so if we want life apart from God, it's a lie. It's an illusion. If we succeed at getting it, we find out that it was death. And never was there such a thing as life apart from God. So we should look at the war the same way God does. We can't win. There's no way for us to get what we want in this war. And the most appropriate thing to do under those circumstances is, while he is yet far away, while the judgment is yet far off, to beg for mercy, to sue for peace, to unconditionally surrender to the one who has already so clearly demonstrated that mercy is freely available to anyone who will lay down their weapons and stop fighting. Truly, the only way for God to win this battle with us is to lose it. And the only way for us to win this battle with him is to lose it. And so paradoxically, again, we see that in order for God to get what he wants, he has to give up everything he has. And in order for us to gain what we want, we need to lay down everything we have. The good news is, when we lay down everything we have, we end up with everything we want. More than we ever imagined. Much more than we could have held on to by holding on to what we have. Unless there is an injection of love from the outside, we're stuck trying to cling on to and hold on to that which we cannot keep. But when we are loved despite ourselves, then we can let go and cling to Jesus as though there is nothing in this world worthy of any time or attention to him. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple.